farmers driving tractors towards the green fields to till the land. But in the future, could this...
lift going up.
...be how they get to work? Farming inside skyscrapers in cities, where it's predicted at least 70% of us will be living by 2050.
We have to rethink and reinvent farming. In another 30 years from now, we'll have, maybe 3 billion more people. Now, where is that land coming from to grow their food?
This is Columbia professor Dixon DePommier, a leading proponent of vertical farming. He believes that this way of farming food uses less resources, reduces food miles, and offers the promise of year-round safe and sustainable production.
We did the calculations based on 2,000 calories per person per day, and one square New York City block, 30 stories high, with a mixed cuisine will feed 50,000 people a year.
I'm going to investigate whether vertical farming is a realistic possibility for feeding us in the future, or, as some people believe, an energy-intensive example of head-in-the-clouds utopian thinking.
I think it's a very romantic idea. I think it's in the same category as cold fusion. Potential, if it were true, to solve so many problems, if it were true. And humans are always hopeful, I think.
The fundamental principle of vertical farming is quite simple, as Dixon DePommier explains.
A vertical farm is more than one story's worth of high-tech greenhouse, uses either artificial light or natural light, that employs hydroponics or aeroponics to grow your food. And that means there's no soil. There are nutrients dissolved in water. They absorb it. They grow just as well that way as they do in soil. It's total control over your plants.
But since he came up with the idea in 1999, all sorts of outlandish designs have been submitted to his website.
What happened is that architects started imagining what vertical farms could be like and started designing these multi-story tower blocks with food growing in them, gleaming with glass and everything. But then on the 30th or the 40th story, all of a sudden it sprouts a forest, you know, solving the world's problems with a vast phallic tower.
Carolyn Steele is an architect, and her book, Hungry Cities, How Food Shapes Our Lives, looks at how cities eat.
I'm delighted that architects are starting to think about the food issues, but the problem is that if you really tried to feed a city from within itself, then you would need, genuinely, thousands and thousands of tower blocks with food growing on every level. You know, so my question is, where's London gone by the time you've done that?
Dixon DePommier, however, disagrees. He argues that this is entirely achievable.
People argue that there's no space, there's no place for this, but that's not true. Ask any mayor of any city whether they've got unused city properties, and the answer is, of course they do. Abandoned warehouses, empty lots. Also, look at how many cranes. If you look out over the skyline of any city, you'll see how much building is going on. Why can't those buildings have mixed uses? Apartment complexes, daycare centers, food production centers, grey water recycling centers. In other words, make it a living building. Make the city behave like an ecosystem.
I've come here to the centre of Dalston in North London, where a design practice called Something and Son have retrofitted a three-storey building into an urban farming hub. It's called Farm Shop, and I'm here to meet Paul Smythe, a co-founder.
What we're doing here is we're actually growing food within the building for our cafe. We think we can do fresher, better, more sustainable food in this way. And also, let's just get people excited about growing food in cities.
And this isn't just about crops, because in front of us, just under the window, the sound of water is because there's these huge fish tanks.
These fish are tilapia. They're actually producing nutrients through their waste and digestive system, which is then used to grow the plants. So we can have no fertiliser input into this system. We were very lucky when we started the project to work with a company called Aquaponics UK, who know all about combining fish farming and lettuce for eating.
So we go from the fish tanks, we follow the pipes. What crops are you growing?
Lettuces, basil, and also got some experimental peppers in there, growing bird's eye chilies.
And there's no sun in here, apart from what's coming through the window. Above the crops, you have these lights. What kind of lights are they?
Fluorescent light, which essentially replicates the frequencies and quality of daylight.
Are they as good as the sun?
No way. But we're working what we got here, and we're trying to experiment about different ways of growing food.
Come on, we'll go upstairs and have a look.
Fantastic. Here we're growing crops right up a wall in the landing. with the plants being grown in little troughs, and we found this actually produces a lot of food for the amount of space it's taking up. You know, stacking different crops on top of each other means you're stacking more metre squareage.
So they're growing in little shelves, and they've also got light shining on them. This is pink light.
Well, here we're using LEDs, because by using LEDs we can reduce the energy consumption of growing substantially. And the reason it's pink is that pink and blue are actually the only lights that scientists tell us that plants see, and therefore you can actually use less energy to grow the same amount of crop. If you compare this to downstairs, it's a much more efficient way of doing things, but there is an additional cost for the LEDs.
The crops downstairs are grown on horizontal shelves, whereas this is very much a vertical stacking system. Which makes more sense? Which is more productive?
Well, I think it really depends on what you're growing. Every different crop needs a different arrangement. If you're growing tomatoes, they're very big plants, you know, they can reach up to 10 metres into the air, and therefore having a shelf system doesn't make sense. If you're growing lettuce leaves, very, very small, the type you'd find cut in your salad bag at home, those may have been grown vertically in stacked systems. Now, the room behind us with the really bright lights, it's called our fruiting room.
This is the closest I've felt to being in the sun, because this room definitely feels warmer.
This is a sodium light, and it's a type of light that's often used in greenhouses in the UK in winter. Trouble with it is, as we're finding, it's very, very energy intensive. We're actually about to decommission the system, because whilst we have grown fantastic tomatoes and chilies for our chutney downstairs, you know, it's actually cheap to buy sodium light, but very expensive to run.
How much?
This system here would cost around, you know, £300 a year to run. That heat it's giving off is waste heat, but it does actually help. You know, a warm condition means your plants produce food more quickly.
And it's about a foot and a half wide, a foot and a half long, and underneath it are six plants, and that looks to me like the maximum amount of plants you could have underneath this.
Well, in this system here, it's not optimised. You know, you can actually get maybe 12 to 20 plants underneath a light of this type. But we're constrained here. You know, we're looking at what was, you know, either side of a chimney breast. And so we're having to make do and mend with what we can.
The constraints of converting an old building into a modern farm became apparent on a project which was actually launched by Dixon de Pommier at Manchester International Festival back in July 2011.
Thank you all for showing up on this wonderful sunny day.
About 8 miles outside of Manchester City in Wythenshawe is an eight-storey grey concrete tower block called Alpha House. I went along there to meet Charlie Baker from Urbed, a design and sustainability cooperative. Charlie is still bubbling with enthusiasm when he explains to me the vision that they had for what would have been Manchester's first ever vertical farm. They were going to engage local communities in urban growing, keep chickens and fish, and then serve everything in a restaurant on the top floor. But then came the reality, money. In order to finance it, Manchester International Festival would have needed to rent out and manage extra office space in the building. And this was just too great a commitment.
We've come to the top floor, a spectacular view of the Greater Manchester area. There are pigeons flying through this top floor. There is pigeon poo all on the ground.
And actually, this is the perfect day for it. So you can see Fiddler's Ferry Power Station all the way over there. The city centre, the Scatmore wind turbines behind them.
So this would have been the Shishi restaurant. What would we have been eating?
Knowing what I know we would have been growing, there'd have definitely been a nice little seared trout fillet. One of those piquant salads with that peppery puff up the nose when you crunch into the rocket. We were looking at the herbs being grown at the table, so that if you needed a little basil garnish, you could just pluck your leaf of basil and drop it on top.
I'm greedy with basil. It would have all been gone had I been sitting there.
We would have a special bit for you then.
And who would have come here?
Well, I think that's the problem. This far out, you have hit upon the point where the director of the festival went, just not quite sure we can feel sufficiently confident about that to be able to invest this much money. One of the things that made this very difficult to work was the business rates. Maybe if you grow food in buildings because of the wider contribution, there is a different fiscal model for how that works.
Given the kind of capital costs, the kind of investment you need to either retrofit a building or build a new one, and the running costs, do you think it is realistic?
Well, define realistic. We do need stuff ahead of the curve. The climate is changing faster than we are prepared to accept. And I have to confess that I have an enduring picture in my mind of central Manchester in 20 years' time. Everyone's realised that it now costs so much money, because there'll be carbon rationing by then, to keep the air conditioning on, that what they've done is they've given up the south-facing meter of all of their floors and they've put these indoor self-contained growing systems into them. So as you look north into Manchester, it's just green in all the tower blocks.
Natural sunlight, of course, is free, so designing a building to maximise it is a very smart move. But Professor Lou Albright, who's an expert in controlled environment agriculture at Cornell University, says it has limitations.
The sun moves. If you look at where the sun is in the summer compared to where it is in the winter, you have a very different condition. And if you, number one, design the building to try to bring in as much light, what season do you design it for? In the summertime, the sun coming in at a very steep angle has very high reflectivity on any glass facing south. East and west will have very little coming in the morning and afternoon. So nothing works very well in the summer. In the winter, the sun rises in the southeast, sets in the southwest, is never very high above the horizon, a lot of diffuse light.
But over in the city of Linköping in Sweden, a company called Plantagon are using natural sunlight, and they expect to be able to produce 500 tons of vegetable each year.
What we are focusing on now is facade systems where you use the southern wall of a high-rise building to grow food on, a spiral, a helical shape. So you plant in one end and then you harvest in the other end.
The vegetable pots are carried on three parallel rotating conveyors, which allows for maximum exposure to sunlight. Plantagon is mainly financed by the Onondaga Nation, Native Americans who are looking for an ethical investment. And Chief Executive Hans Hassel has found one. He argues that the only sustainable way to power the conveyors, the extra lighting and ventilate the humidity is to use renewable energy.
In Linköping, we actually use spillage heat from the district heating power plant, about 30% coming from heat that is today just let out into the stream. The energy that we buy is from wind power energy. Then we also use carbon dioxide that we lead to the greenhouse from a local biogas plant. So what we are trying to achieve is that waste inside the city becomes tradable goods, because then it gets economy into the whole system and then it works.
Of course, using renewable energy and deciding to use it in growing food is a choice in itself, taking that energy away from another project.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that still make sense?
I don't know. There are many things you can actually question with vertical farming and urban agriculture as a whole. But I still think that we will have to grow very much food inside cities. I think we will have to do it on an industrial scale. Maybe we are wrong, and in a way that would be good. Very bad for the company, of course, but for humanity it would be good.
I'm on a train in Holland on my way to meet a horticultural engineer. And what's interesting about his work is that he has turned his back on the sun. Indeed, he sees the sun as a problem when it comes to growing crops.
My name is Gert-Jan Meus and I'm one of the four managing partners of PlantLab.
When you look at plants growing outside in the sun, in the air, in soil, what do you think?
It's old-fashioned. I like to see this, but this is not a way to feed the world in future.
Are they in a kind of hell and we're entering paradise?
They are really in hell.
It really reminds me of being in a hospital here.
It's white, it's clean, it's doors that you know from the laboratory.
Wow. This is like going into a disco.
It is.
So in front of us we have three shelves, and on each shelf there are trays of hundreds and hundreds of little seedlings. What has been grown here?
These are young vegetable plants.
They look purple.
They look purple.
So do you. Because the light is pink here. So how are these plants getting energy?
Exactly the same as they do outside in the sunlight. So what they absorb in the chloroplasts is red and blue light and a little far red.
And what is it outside that these plants don't like?
They have to adapt to ever-changing suboptimal circumstances. So they are very able to do so, but they are never reaching the maximum performance because there is always something wrong. If light is okay, carbon dioxide is a problem, and if that's okay, it's too hot or too cold, or there is not enough water or far too much water. And in our system, we give them what they want. Here, you feel a little air. It's coming out of these holes. We can change by heating or cooling down the root temperature and change it from the leaf temperature. And in different stages of growth of vegetables, they like warm feet or cold feet. The noise that you hear is a valve that opens and closes for adding carbon dioxide.
So what's the productivity difference between what you're doing in here and outside in the allotment?
If you compare closed environment vertical farming with the open field and you compare the year-round production, meaning there is also winter time, day and night time, we could produce 20 or 30 times more than in the open field.
What crops are more economically viable than others?
Pharmaceutics, herbs and a lot of vegetables are viable today. And with the performance increase of the LEDs and our performance in getting higher yields, within the next 3 to 5 to 7 years, more and more and more crops will be economically feasible.
So, in this brave new world of vertical farming, we'd have plenty of salad and vegetables. But what about those old staples, wheat, rice, corn and soybeans? Gertjan Meus predicts, with some confidence, that he'll be able to grow a viable wheat crop within a decade, but only if two things happen. That, as predicted, the price of LED lighting falls by 75% in the next 3 years, and if LEDs almost double in efficiency. Others are not so convinced.
The nutrients are much more dense in, say, a kernel of wheat or a soybean. Those are primarily starches and proteins and lipids that require a lot of energy to produce, whereas vegetables are largely water and cellulose.
Stan Cox is a senior scientist at the Land Institute in Kansas. Stan has calculated that to grow America's 53 million acres of wheat indoors, you'd need 8 times as much electricity as all the US utilities produce in an entire year. And that's just for the lighting. So how much would it add to the cost of a loaf of bread? Professor Lou Albright has done the sums.
The loaf of bread produced by the sun, the wheat, is maybe 5 or 10 cents per loaf. If we had to take that same wheat and grow it in a closed facility, it would cost roughly between $25 and $30 per loaf for just the electricity.
Our claims that advances in the development of LED lights, are those claims justified, do you think?
Today, no. The best LEDs are equivalent to the best high-pressure sodium lights in terms of efficiency. But even if the lights were 100% efficient, that loaf of bread would still cost $5 for just the electricity. I think there are only 3 cases where the electricity would be so cheap that this could work. Number one, if all the world started to run on renewable fuels. Number two, if all the world started to run on nuclear fission. Or number three, if all the world, if we solved the problem of fusion, then we won't have to worry about the cost of electricity. But until then, we do.
A $25 loaf of bread. That's a terrifying prospect. But Dixon Dupommier would like us to ask another question about existing intensive farming methods.
How much fossil fuels did they burn planting, harvesting, shipping, storing, processing? United States farm industry burns 20% of our fossil fuels. Do you know how much energy that is? That's $700 billion worth of energy.
Is there not an argument to say, though, that the oil in the vertical farming system is the cost of the energy, the lights?
Yeah, that's true. But if I had your subsidies for outdoor farming, I could do it twice as cheap. So the same rules apply to both. Indoor farming wins hands down. Because I go year-round. You get one crop a year. I get 5, 6, 7.
But there's another weakness with this system of vertically growing our food indoors, which Carolyn Steele feels could leave us vulnerable.
We saw with Hurricane Superstorm Sandy what can happen to a city as sophisticated and functional as New York. I mean, this was shocking. The bottom third of Manhattan lost power for days on end. Now, imagine if the food for that city was being produced by some super sophisticated system that relied on monitoring every moment of every day of what, you know, some plant root needed in its plant paradise. It would have been a complete disaster. I mean, the food system would have been taken out possibly for months. You cannot afford to have this. You know, we need resilient food systems that can bounce back.
Ironically, extreme weather events like droughts, floods and earthquakes have already sparked an interest in bringing food growing indoors. In Japan, the government has invested in research and development since 1974. They call them plant factories. The first were subsidised, but now businesses are growing lettuce, leafy vegetables, tomatoes, blueberries, Chinese medicinal herbs and even rice in more than 200 facilities across the country. So what's made them so popular? Mr. Takio Geshi is the Deputy Director of Regional Economic and Industrial Policy.
There are a few reasons. First of all, plant factories make use of a controlled environment for farming, and that means effective cultivation and leads to making more money. So the younger generation, who might not have been interested in growing vegetables, see this as an effective business model, and elderly people can have a job where they can work without too much effort. Another reason is that after the earthquake with the tsunami, the farming lands were damaged. So with the plant factory schemes, we do not depend on the outdoor environment. And because those vegetables are safe, use less or no pesticides, consumers are finding those vegetables more attractive, and they enjoy eating them. So in the tsunami-affected areas, there is growing interest in starting plant factories.
Japan isn't alone in looking indoors and upwards for more growing space. The Korean government has invested in a research facility looking at vertical farming too. And unsurprisingly, countries like Holland, where farmland is limited, such as China, India, Singapore and Hong Kong, are increasingly interested in any technology that uses less land and reduces their dependency on imported food. So are we witnessing the birth of a new concept, the professional urban farmer?
I'm an urban farmer. I say that to my peers and my friends. I've traded my Brooks Brothers dress shirts for Levi's 401s and a T-shirt.
Entrepreneur Galen Williams is the CEO of Sky Greens Aquaponics. He set up his company in a retrofit building called The Plant. It's Chicago's first licensed vertical farm.
I'm in there 7 days a week. It's like farming. We check the water levels. We make sure that there's a good balance between alkaline and acidity, fertilizer in the water, humidity, the temperature of the last 24 hours, and last but not least, of course, you look at the greens.
So last but not least, you look at the greens. So everything else that you've listed there,
yes,
is about looking at technology. Computers, yes. Is it?
Yes, we log it digitally. As we grow larger and get more investment, a lot of this can be automated. I shouldn't say look at the greens last. That's the first thing you see. You see these beautiful greens. The room has a great smell. It's humid.
Can you understand why people listening may think with this amount of involvement of technology and also the fact that you don't use soil and you don't use the sun, that this isn't really farming at all?
I agree. It is farming, though. It's just a different way of doing it. Am I a traditional farmer with a horse or a combine with thousands of acres? No. Am I still making sure that greens have their calcium, phosphates, etc.? Yes.
But you call yourself a farmer first and a businessman second.
It's hard to separate them now. I don't know the difference anymore, Ella. I don't know.
Galen grows microgreens and herbs and sells them to shishi restaurants that will pay a premium. It's a great marketing ploy. You can see it on the menu, garnished with local rocket grown here in Chicago City. But while it may briefly assuage middle-class guilt about food miles, it's hardly going to feed those on a budget. But does our current way of farming food reflect its true cost? Carolyn Steele.
There was a study done recently by the Centre of Environment in India which reckoned that if you internalise the true cost of a hamburger made from meat raised on land recently cleared of rainforest, and you internalised all the consequences of this kind of diet in terms of climate change, soil degradation, water depletion, obesity, type 2 diabetes, blah, 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 it ought to cost $200. You know, so that gives you some idea of the degree to which we're externalising the true cost of industrial food.
And this is what's fundamentally driving Dixon Depommier. He wants land, which has been damaged by farming, to be rewilded, returned to its natural habitat.
The biggest reason for wanting to do this is the economic gain that you get by giving land back to nature. What's 10 acres of forest worth? I will guarantee you that the amount of money that you get back in terms of ecosystem services for clean air, clean water, biodiversity, and all the other good things that we talk about when we talk about an intact ecosystem will far outweigh the cost of producing our food in a tall building somewhere.
Even the critics of vertical farming recognize that we can't afford to sacrifice any more land to agricultural production for the sake of our own survival and also for biodiversity.
That was the sound of an Aldabra tortoise eating chicory. If we want wild animals on the planet, we've got to think and act differently.
Kevin Frediani is the curator of plants and gardens at Paignton Zoo in Devon. He's become one of the leading experts on vertical farming in Britain. He's been testing a high-density system to feed the animals, developed by a company called Alteris, which grows crops vertically.
So from the outside, it looks like your standard large greenhouse, but when you come in, Kevin, suddenly it looks all so different. Shelves upon shelves upon shelves of moving, rotating plants.
Yeah, 8 shelves, 120 plants on each of our hangars, and there's 70 hangars on a closed loop that runs around 85 square metres of space.
Researchers at Plymouth University have established that the nutritional value of greens grown in these optimised conditions is off the scale when compared with shop-bought veg. Over in Vancouver, Alteris has installed this vertically stacked system on the top of a disused car park. Within the next 5 years, they want to install similar systems in every city in North America. It's a lucrative prospect, as Kevin realises.
This system, growing basil, will generate £132,000 profit every year after 23 months of production.
And what will be the energy costs out of that?
It's 32 kilowatts per day. A kilowatt hour here is 6 pence, so it's £1.24 a day.
But Kevin is also clear that this technology should be owned by those who need it the most.
We've got people living in Plymouth, for instance, that have food poverty. They can't afford a lettuce. But I work with community groups where I can make you a hydroponic farm for £250 in your own back garden.
So we have a system here where there's two big basins. Yep. In one is a tomato crop, about six plants, and then below here is the other basin. Yep. Lift the lid.
And here we've got 10 fish. And the fish provide waste that feed my tomato crops.
And you're saying this could be a model for families in their homes.
And it is. If you look underneath the tomatoes, we're also growing lettuces and watercress, so you can have all of those crops growing in this bed.
But in the future, if we did have to rely on vertical farms, who will own the technology? Carolyn Steele.
This is where we get into the really interesting and murky territory. Who's going to own these vertical farms? Who's going to put the research in? Who's going to fund them? Are they going to be state-owned? Are they going to be owned by Monsanto? I mean, we now have the most important thing in all of our lives basically being controlled by vast, global, unelected corporations who can more or less do what they like.
Etienne Muse of Plant Lab says that his company has had to patent the technology to recoup the millions they've spent on research, but that they're open to sharing it with the right partners.
If you have a production plant in Africa, and let's say that somebody who has the money offers us a solar plant so that electricity is for free, you could feed one human being for less than 20 euros a year. That's not unaffordable. That's politics. It's surprising for us, people who say that they want to change the world haven't called yet, and they're very welcome to do so.
Vertical farming raises as many questions as it answers, and I'm certainly left with serious doubts about its ability to deliver on its lofty promises. But is it just too early, as Kevin Frediani believes, to dismiss this idea before it's been truly tested?
At the moment, there's no support here from research institutions. There's no government interest at all in terms of food security. They're not looking at increasing and diversifying the agricultural base of the UK. So it takes a zoo working with a private company to realise the first production model of a vertical farm. The UK could lead this field, and this is going to make a difference not just for us but for everyone. And with a market of 7 billion people increasing to 9 billion people, I can think of nothing else better to invest your money in.